I once boarded with an adorable English lady in Oxford who would say to me frequently in the mornings something like this, "Hello, Bob. It's raining out today. Mucky. If you like that, as well as I do, if you're charmed by the elegant version of an English accent, I will tell you in advance that on the last Sunday of this month, Martin Haugill will speak to you in my place. And you can have as much of it as he has it in him to give you. I have been promised that the air conditioning system will be functioning by Tuesday. I've been very reluctant to mention a man by the name of Dr. Gene Scott to most of you, for fear you would not believe my descriptions. But since Bob Goetz has found him and put the description in print, I recommend that anyone who likes to marvel at human nature take a look at this television evangelist around midnight on Channel 3 some evening when you can't sleep. I make no other judgments. I have sometimes disliked the phrase beautiful people as a descriptive term for jet setters, international playboys and playgirls. Last Sunday, watching the young people of this church conduct the Sunday worship, I found a new meaning for it. Lisa and Bill and Ray and Elizabeth, Ashley and Ben, all of you in the choir that day, you made us feel very good about the present of this church and about its future. Truly beautiful people. One night in a seaport city called Troas, on the coast of what is now Turkey, a Jewish rabbi who had been converted to Christianity had a vision. He saw a man standing on the opposite side of the Aegean Sea, pleading for a visit. "Come over to Macedonia and help us." Some people have thought that the man of this vision, beckoning from across more than 100 miles of salt water, was Luke himself, who wrote that history of early preaching which is called Acts, and who may have talked with Paul earlier about the idea of preaching the gospel for the first time on the soil of Europe. My guess is that this idea intrigued Paul, that he thought about it until it took possession of his mind, and that the vision of the man inviting him to come to Greece was simply a pictorial way of describing his response to a great opportunity. So one night, dreaming or awake in that clear and inescapable light that sometimes comes only at night, Paul promised to sail across the blue water to Macedonia, land of Alexander the Great. He was not a man to waste time. He got up the next morning and left right after breakfast. He had no way of knowing that when he got to the chief city of the district, a place called Philippi, named for Alexander's father, he would end up in jail. But if he had known, I suppose he would not have been much surprised. Paul spent a lot of time in jail. Good men, we discover, have often sat in cells built for criminals because they were considered too dangerous by somebody to be granted freedom. Socrates, Gandhi, Bonhoeffer, King, a close friend of mine who lives in Dallas and is named Leroy Garrett. It's a long list because there are times and issues when it is hard for a truly honest and committed man to stay out of jail. I hope I am not ashamed someday that I did not go to prison for insisting that our lack of serious effort to get rid of nuclear weapons is probably the greatest single insanity of human history. Anyway, Paul preached on a riverbank in Philippi, liberated a poor slave girl from some men who were making money out of her gift of clairvoyance. Perhaps it was her madness. And then got thrown into jail for having interfered with their profits. He won a few converts, left town, and sometime later from still another jail cell, he wrote a letter back which we have now been reading for several weeks. I've chosen this morning to look at some isolated sentences from that letter. And the first is a comment he makes about some people whose appetite, he says caustically, is their God. Paul is sometimes diplomatic, but not this time. I have told you often, and I repeat it today with tears, there are many who are behaving as the enemies of the cross of Christ. They make foods into their gods. I think Paul is talking about Jewish converts who made too much noise in the new Christian church about the dietary laws of their old religion. They were saying to Greek Christians, you can join our new church, in fact, we'd like to have you, but we were here first, and you can only join if you also adopt our taboos and restrictions about what to eat and when to eat it. Paul was the first great liberal in the church, so this kind of tyranny drove him up the wall. You can't turn food into a god, he told them, even when the food has been an important part of your own religious background. These new people knew nothing of those dietary laws, and they don't have to. All they have to do is accept the joy and freedom of life in Christ, who, after all, broke some of those food laws himself. None of this means anything to us in 1986. We aren't burdened with laws about what to eat if we want to please God. We may be burdened, as no other generation in history has been, with theories about what to eat if we want to stay slim and please each other, but it has nothing to do with religion. The verse doesn't speak to us on that level, but it may speak on another. Would it be too harsh to say that America is, among so many other wonderful things, the land of gluttony? I read constantly that overeating, excessive indulgence in rich foods, is the single greatest medical problem in this country. Would Paul, if he were writing to us from a jail in Chicago, tell us that we spend so much time and money on rich food that we seem to worship it? That our appetite has become the god we serve? I have to be careful when I talk about this, because my background may easily cause me to overreact. I grew up in the Great Depression, when all I knew was that we ate because we were hungry, and that if we had anything exotic on the table, we were incredibly lucky. I was not allowed ever to be picky or to beg for something else. My father was the sort who could and did say, this is what we have for dinner. If you don't like it, You may leave the table and go to your room. If you choose to stay, do not complain. I still watch with amazement those mothers who prepare what in my childhood would have been a banquet, only to have the children reject it, call for something else, and, miracle of miracles, get a second dinner cooked more to their liking. I may as well go all the way with this confession. I have friends who spend $100 on an evening meal for two, and who show no sign of even a slightly unsettled conscience. I like food as well as anybody, far too much, I think. But I've never been able entirely to cast off the feeling that in a world where people go to bed hungry, I have sometimes made my appetite into a god. My life's companion has tried, with only limited success, to teach me that it is not a mark of singular virtue to eat at furs. I would prefer not to seem positively silly to you, but I have felt uneasy at times to discover people who spend amazing amounts of time and energy planning where to get the finest food and how to surround the meal with the most lavish ambience, and who complain bitterly if they are disappointed in either one. I am not a judge. I simply ask whether there may be in America a degree of obsession with food that could be called idolatry. I'm not sure I would know how or where to draw the line, but I do know that we tend not to recognize our own idolatries. We react with scorn or amusement to those plump little Buddhas in Japan, or to grotesque carvings on a totem pole, and we forget our own idols, which are everywhere because they are familiar to us, and we do not think of them as such. I have students who worship cars and clothing with far more devotion than most church members aim at God. A girl told me the other day that she had no time to study for her classes because she had to work 40 hours a week. When I asked her how she thought it possible to be educated on such limited available time, she said, "I don't know. But I love clothes, and I have to work that much to pay for them." She frankly admits that her God is fashion. A boy cannot stay awake in class. He is obviously exhausted and not just another victim of my dullness. I ask why he's so tired. He says, "I bought a brand new bright yellow Chrysler convertible. I work 6 hours, 7 days a week to pay for it. I try to explain how much time it takes to learn. He doesn't hear me. And please believe me, I'm not feeling smug. I've had my own little pantheon of gods over a lifetime. I know how easily I could turn almost anything I wanted into a form of idolatry. So I listen when Paul speaks of those who make a god of their appetites, and so should you." I listen, too, when he writes a line that, to my mind, indicts this generation more than anything else in his letter. And now, my friends, fill your minds with everything that is true, everything that is noble, everything that is just and pure, everything that is lovable and gracious, whatever is excellent and admirable, fill all your thoughts with these things. Quite by accident, as I studied those words, in hope of making them come alive for you this morning, I was also reading journals, which my students had kept this year in a writing class. I had begged them to be honest, because we usually write best when we write out of our deepest feelings. Well, they were honest. And they were not trying to shock me, because it had become clear in class by that time that the teacher was not so easily shockable. What I got was a profile of what they thought about daily, what captured their minds apart from the mundane business of eating and sleeping and staying healthy. I had descriptions of more drunken parties than I had supposed I would read about, and crude, clumsy seduction efforts which sometimes failed, sometimes, they admitted, succeeded, of fears of pregnancy, of abortions when the pregnancy happened, of bitter quarrels with parents, of the great carnival of spring break to which they looked forward in so many pages, and which came down, to judge from what they wrote me, to bar hopping and casual propositions, and I am graphic, but I am remembering accurately, to slipping in puddles of vomit on bathroom floors where roommates had been sick earlier in the evening. Some of it written in language once thought extraordinarily vulgar, but not anymore, since it's heard at the movies or in every den and living room on television. Now I've embarrassed myself. Even though what I've just told you is true, I'm embarrassed because I sound like a preacher right now, and I try consciously not to do that. You may want to dismiss what I'm saying. I realize that the kids are better than that, and that almost all of them will grow up to be responsible citizens. It's just such a terrifying revelation to me that even for a while, their minds are so filled with the trivial and the trashy, the cheap and crude, the ugly and violent, furnishings provided for them by the magazines they read and the art forms they watch. Then I would remember Paul. Fill your minds with everything that is noble and just and lovable and gracious. Think about what is admirable and excellent. And I kept reading those pages filled with anger, depression, vindictiveness, jealousy, pouting, getting into bed without a word of love, losing the chance for excellence by wanting a new dress or a new car more than anything else. I looked for something about sacrifice and devotion and courage and discipline and commitment to high causes, and I found, I say it with sorrow, not with arrogance, I found trivia. Am I simply betraying my age or my profession? Or does it make any difference what we fill our heads with? I keep thinking it does, partly because of the years I've seen, partly because I believe a scripture which says, as you think, so you are. The pressure to think like everybody else is enormous. The courage to resign occasionally from the herd and think for yourself is rare. I'd like to believe it might help a little this week to think of Paul's advice one more time. Fill your mind with what is true. That is, try not to be mistaken. Don't decide too quickly on the basis of what may be false. Whatever is just It means to treat people fairly in the store, in the living room, on a date. It means not to take advantage to somebody else's hurt and your profit. Whatever is pure, it means to say no to malice and gossip and verbal sewage, and yes to loyalty and friendship and images of beauty and grace. It's as much challenge as any of us can handle, I should think, on any given Sunday morning. So I now simply wish you good luck.